Welcome back to our next podcast. Today's topic is going to be staging. That probably sounds a little boring to some of you, but it turns out it's pretty important to having a successful response to an active shooter event. My name is Bill Godfrey, your host for the podcast. I'm one of the instructors here at C3 Pathways, and I am joined by three of our other instructors, Ken Lamb, law enforcement sergeant. Actually, Ken, you're up for promotion, aren't you?
I am. Couple months. All really right. Looking forward to it, and looking forward to talking about staging today.
Fantastic. Well, welcome, Ken. We're also joined by Robert McMahon, recently retired chief deputy out of Colorado. How's retirement feeling, Robert?
It's awesome. It's awesome. Really enjoying it.
Absolutely. And of course, many of you are a familiar instructor to the podcast, Bruce Scott, retired from the fire service. Bruce, thanks for coming in again.
Hey, thanks a lot, Bill. Appreciate it.
So we're going to talk about staging today, as we said, and this is a familiar topic to the fire service. And in some cases, it may even be a yawner or a gloss over, but it really shouldn't be. As we talk today, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the differences between doing staging in an active shooter event versus how we might stage in a structure fire. So there's certainly some important stuff here for the fire service overall. But clearly the fire service is familiar with the idea of staging. Use it almost every day and use it regularly enough to be pretty good at it in most cases. But what about law enforcement? Ken, Robert, what is staging important to law enforcement? Is it something that law enforcement by and large sees as a necessity in events like these or in large events?
Right. So in events such as an active shooter event, staging is important, and it is part of the, it's really embedded in our policy as far as making sure that our units are staging prior to arriving after the first five or six responders have made it on scene to neutralize the threat. Where it does become problematic is that you have a lot of radio traffic that's taking place in that initial response. And sometimes people get caught up in the initial response and forget about the staging, so that it can complicate efforts if you don't have one person that's thinking about staging, stops short, starts relaying or communicating to responding units to move to staging. And what we see is an overconvergence on the target if staging isn't set up. And it also, what we find out, takes some pretty skillful communication with fire rescue in order to coordinate that staging location, because most times, and as you mentioned, fire rescue has already established staging. So even if we have that one person that says, hey, I'm going to stop short and I'm going to stage here, we have to make sure that we're staging with fire rescue, because if not, they can surely complicate matters as well.
You know, Robert, Ken's talking from a perspective of, I think, you know, an agency that's already culturally kind of adopted that posture, or at least in the process of doing that. And I know that the agency you came from had done that as well, but it wasn't always that way. You kind of led through that transition. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, Ken makes some great points. And, you know, one of the problems that we had in one of our active shooter events was not getting law enforcement and fire to staging together. And what it resulted in is an inability to get sufficient security assigned to RTFs so that they could be ready to go downrange and take care of patients. And the overconvergence piece is huge. That's the first thing that's going to happen if responding officers don't respond to staging once you get those initial contact teams going. And they're going to overwhelm your incident. They're going to run over the top of you, and you're going to spend all your time trying to get your arms around that instead of doing other critical things that get patients to the hospital and save lives.
So you're talking about one of the lessons that you guys learned. And Robert, if memory serves me correctly, you've responded to three active shooter events in your career. Am I remembering that right?
Yes.
As we always want to try to draw lessons learned from that, I know you shared with me and with the audience now some of the lessons learned from that particular response. But did it take? Has the message penetrated in the organization that you were a part of and in your surrounding communities? What's been the net effect of that? Was kind of learning that lesson once enough to turn the water?
You would like to say so, but not always. I think we turn a little bit each time, and we get a little better each time. But it does take a lot of effort to get law enforcement to change and adapt to go with these staging models that we're talking about, because, you know, we're cops. We want to run to the gunfire. We want to go take care of the bad guy, and that's well and good, but there's other things to do in the incident besides that. And over time, I think law enforcement has gotten a lot better, but we certainly have to be more disciplined in the staging process and getting our resources to a place that they are ready to deploy with a mission and get a job done.
You know, before we leave this topic, can you share a little bit more for the listeners on the details of the incident that you don't have to necessarily give the specifics, but just kind of set the stage for them a little bit and tell them the practical implications of what happened to you guys.
Sure. We had an active shooter incident in Colorado not too long ago, just a few years ago, that resulted in 8 students being shot. And the initial response was handled very well by the initial responding officers. They got in and took care of the threats. But it was the other officers that kept coming. We had some neighboring agencies, and they just overwhelmed us. They just kept coming and coming and coming right on top of the incident. And that resulted in an overconvergence, like Ken talked about, on the incident, and creating chaos in the incident that didn't need to happen. You know, these incidents are chaotic enough without having an overconvergence of resources that you're not in control of. And the second thing that resulted was not having enough officers to assign to the RTF teams, and they just would not move out of staging without that, and they're not supposed to. And so we had to, our officers adapted to that, and they got the students out and to medical help quickly anyway, but that would have been a much better response to provide medical personnel to them at the casualty collection point rather than having to drag them out and put them in ambulances on the street.
So if I'm understanding you correctly and reading between the lines, you had a staging location that was established that that your organization had set up and had effectively up and running, but when your neighboring agencies, mutual aid, I presume, rolled into the incident, they didn't go to the staging area you'd set up?
That's correct. And one of the reasons for that is they were listening to their main channel instead of going to our channel, which the incident was occurring on. And that's one of the things that we have talked about in the past. And one of the agreements that we had in place at the time was to go to the main agency's channel to get those instructions. And that didn't occur. And we debriefed it. They owned it, and that's fine. And I think they're learning from that. I think we learned from that. But we did establish staging right away, and our fire brothers were great at doing that. And so we had staging, but just no cops at staging that could be deployed to specific duties.
So Bruce, Robert's talking about, you know, having the staging area set up and having fire rescue ready to go. Can you talk us, I know you've done it, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of times in your career, rolling into staging for a structure fire or other incident, but can you talk a little bit about what makes staging a little different for fire and EMS in an active shooter event than a structure fire?
Yeah, and there's a whole lot of difference, Bill. Number one, on an active shooter incident, the first thing that's going to be different is ideally you're going to have a law enforcement staging manager there side by side with you, right? So you can begin, you know, as Robert was alluding to, begin forming up those rescue task forces with that law enforcement staging officer. You know, typically on the fire department, you know, we stage, we wait for the incident commander to say, hey, engine one, come on down to the scene, or engine two, lay me a line, or ladder one, you know, ladder the rear of the building. And you get those orders directly from the incident commander. And the model that we use and being taught nationally now is a standard. You may be getting those orders from tactical. You may be getting those orders from triage. You may be getting those orders from transport to fill those resource requests. So the only way to overcome this, so you don't figure it out on the day that bad things happen, adopt it as policy, train to those policies, and then exercise those policies with both all the agencies that may be involved. And that's the only way you can overcome it, so you don't deal with this problem when the bad things happen.
So one of the things that jumps out at me is, you know, in most models, you've got a single staging manager and maybe a deputy manager. We found out years ago that doesn't work very well here. You need at least one law enforcement staging manager. You need at least one fire EMS staging manager. If EMS is separate, you need a staging manager for them. Basically, for each one of the radio channels that you're using,
absolutely,
you're going to need some. And those staging managers together literally have to be together, work it together. It's not like they stand on different sides of the parking lot. They're standing, working together to make the team assignments. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So they're in their hip pocket. So if Ken and I were working staging together, we'd be talking constantly. Him being a sergeant and soon to be lieutenant on the sheriff's office, he has some authority, right? So he can tell those officers, he can direct those officers. And, you know, and myself as a captain of the fire department, I could certainly tell, you know, tell these units, this is what we're doing, right? So we have some authority in the staging manager positions that can kind of direct those folks. You know, in the fire service, you know this, Bill, you spent a long time in the fire department. We used to use our, I hate to say this, our weakest link to be our staging manager, right? We knew they were probably not do well down at the fire scene, so we would use that resource to the best of our ability. That cannot be the case in an active shooter incident. You need to have your well-trained, well-versed that can listen to what's going on their onto their radios and lean forward and prepare for what they think may happen next. Go ahead and begin assembling those resources.
I completely agree with you there. You know, culturally, do you think it's a challenge for the fire service to kind of recognize that active shooter event is a little bit different in the way it gets managed and to let go of some of the, I'm not even sure what to call it, the rigidity of the ICS of having to flow those things through the commander that they, I'm not even sure quite how to phrase that question, Bruce, but you know where I'm trying to go? The, you know, culturally, how difficult is it for us to get fire service to recognize that just because the way they do it on a structure fire works doesn't necessarily mean that's the best model here. And that's all still okay under incident command system. You know, the incident commander can designate that authority to the staging manager to issue that stuff.
And should delegate that authority to the staging manager.
What are the cultural things that you think get in the way of that, and how do we overcome it?
Again, I think the only way to overcome it is to practice it, where it becomes part of your normal organizational culture, right? You can't expect to have a plan and do something one way 99.9% of the time, and then on this one particular type of incident, change the way you do things. So I think, again, practicing it, using special events to practice it, where you're staging extra officers or extra fire rescue folks at special events, use every opportunity you can have available to you to practice it. But our own organizational cultures get in our way, right? You know, we used to say in the fire service, we spent, you know, 200 years of tradition unimpeded by progress.
It's funny. I was thinking that when Robert was talking about how law enforcement is slow to change, I'm thinking, no, not compared to fire service. It's like comparing a glacier to a flowing river.
Yeah, we've gotten better at it, I think. You know, we're constantly in this training mode now and recognizing the importance of training. But, again, I think the only answer to this is to adopt a policy, train that policy, and practice that policy. And that's the only way you're going to overcome it long term.
So, Ken, we're talking about the culture of the fire service kind of getting in the way a little bit here and having to overcome that. What about the culture in law enforcement towards staging?
Right. So
your organization made the shift, or at least is trying to make the shift. Of the four of us here, you're the only one still on active duty.
Right.
What was that like? What's that culture shift like? And what do you have to say to get officers to understand it?
Right. So what I like to tell my officers, I learned from Billy Perry, which you're obviously familiar with, is we need thinkers and doers and shooters, right? So I need officers that want to be part of the solution, but I also need officers to want to be have the ability to think outside of the box. So if they recognize that there are enough resources downrange taking care of the problem, then take a step back and realize what else needs to be taken care of. And in this case, say, hey, I'm going to set up a staging area at this location and coordinate that with the dispatcher. And one thing that I love about your programs is that it incorporates the dispatcher, because I think the dispatcher or the telecommunication expert can be a critical piece to this in constantly putting over the radio when they're able to, the location of staging, and reminding officers to respond to staging instead of going to the target location. Because oftentimes, the tunnel vision sets in with these officers, and understandably so. Traumatic event has taken place, and they want to get there and be part of the solution. And what we've been taught since baby officers is stop the killing, stop the dying. So they want to go and achieve those two objectives. But the reality is, it doesn't take many officers to achieve that objective. And we have a whole lot of other people or a whole lot of other responders trying to be part of the solution coming, and we need to start getting our arms wrapped around this. And when we have thinkers, doers, and shooters, I think that finding their place in those three is really key to organizing this response and having a successful response and achieving the stop the killing and the stop the dying and getting those people who are injured or survivors who are injured to the hospital within that golden hour.
So Ken, Robert was talking a little bit about his personal experience in an incident there. I know you were a responder on one of the active shooter events,
right,
in Jacksonville.
Absolutely.
What were your experiences? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So one of the challenges that we had is that we had placed our incident location staging command post, our witness holding area. We had placed those very close to the target location. That complicated efforts for a variety of reasons. I mean, the first being that you had a large amount of resources right across the street from the incident location, which led to folks who were not in the field level management diving into the field level management, if that makes sense to you. And it also was confusing as to who was checking into staging, who was assigned, who was doing what. And I think a lot of those problems can be solved by having some distance between those locations. And when we talk about staging, having that staging in a cold zone and easily identifiable by all the responders, as well as the individuals that are assigned to the incident, so that you know where to go get available resources. Because many times you would run across an officer and, hey, I need someone, you know, we need someone to do this. And what are you doing? Well, I'm doing this and I'm doing that. And it was difficult to differentiate who was doing what. And I think that some distance in that staging location would have assisted.
So if I'm understanding, you're saying that your staging location was almost literally across the street,
right,
from,
right,
the attack site.
Right. And I don't necessarily fault the initial response, because there was a lot going on. Understandably so, there was some conflicting information that was coming in, which led them to stage at that location. But I think that at some point in time, when additional resources arrive and you recognize this, probably change this location and back this up a little bit and identify this as the new staging location and move any available resources to that location so that we know the pool to draw from. And it eliminates a lot of the confusion in an already complicated situation.
Well, that makes sense. So you're describing a problem that's a little bit different than what Robert was talking about. Did you have any problems with mutual aid or non-agency units,
yes,
not coming to staging or things like that?
We had problems with units that were not of our agency coming to the command post. So they weren't even checking in and staging. They were just coming straight to the command post. And part of that was due to our setup and the fact that we were so close. But I remember numerous alphabet agencies in the command post that had not checked into staging, and it certainly did complicate things.
Does that sound familiar, Robert?
Yes, it does. I want to talk quick about a point Ken brought up about dispatch helping out with reminding where that is. And I think that's very important. You get that information out repeatedly so that people coming in to service that, oh, we heard something's going on, they go jump on the radio, they get that information about where staging's at. I went as far with our dispatchers I gave them the checklist, and, you know, one of the roles that tactical has is to set up staging right away. And I told dispatch, if tactical gets up and running and he doesn't tell you where staging is, ask him. where would you like staging? And that reminds them. That's a conversation that everybody's having, like, oh, yeah, we got staging. We got to do that. And that helps get the process rolling in the right direction.
It's interesting how much sway dispatchers can have on an event going smoothly. And the idea of having them prompt that is something we try to reinforce in training. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But giving the dispatchers the checklist, making sure that they're just as educated on the checklist and the items and the terminology as the responders, I think is critically important. Bruce, would you agree?
Absolutely. And I'm glad Robert brought the point up, because that's the point that I wanted to bring up as well, right? I don't know how many times in my career our dispatcher saved my butt and reminded me of things that I had forgotten about, right? I mean, just simple little things like, hey, command, where'd you put your staging area? Dang, I didn't put a staging area. Maybe I should do that, right? So I don't know how many times they've saved us, right?
Absolutely. And I think that those items, not only empowering the dispatchers, but the other piece is that, you know, they got to have the training, which I think is one of the reasons it's so important, as Ken mentioned, to have dispatchers be part of the training we do, is they need to know what the process is supposed to be. What is it supposed to look like? What is it supposed to sound like? And what are the elements that are critical that if they're missed, I probably, as you just saying, Bruce, I probably ought to provide a gentle reminder that we need that benchmark. So, Ken, I'm interested to know if you're comfortable talking about it, because I realize this wasn't that long ago.
Right.
With the staging area almost literally across the scene from the attack site, was it a problem for you to get your fire department to stage with you in the same staging area?
So the interesting part of that response is by the time the follow-on resources arrived, the fire department had already taken the survivors and transported them to the hospital. So they were gone. So it was kind of chaotic. We did eventually get them back and be part of our response. But Bruce can comment more on this than I could. But in my experience, they travel as a package. So when they arrive as a package, they're all leaving as a package.
And the interesting thing on that particular call is that they weren't the first responding fire units weren't dispatched. They were literally across the street doing some training exercises at a parking garage, and heard the shots and people screaming, running out of the landing. So the firemen did what firemen do.
Absolutely,
they ran to it without any help.
That's a whole new meaning to first responder.
Absolutely. Right. So I think that led to what Ken's alluding to, is some difficulty getting them out of the hot zone because they were already in there treating the wound.
So Ken, more recently, you had a civil unrest incident that required a fairly large response.
Right.
And if I remember correctly, you inherited the staging manager role.
Absolutely. And I was excited to do it because obviously been to this training, assist in the instruction. So I was excited to take on that responsibility. And I remember watching this play out on TV and I was like, oh, I can totally run this staging. Let's do it. And I got the call.
How'd it go?
It went really well. At first, so there were a lot of challenges. The first challenge that I had to overcome is, and we really don't think about this in time, but you have to get permission from individuals to use their property. I mean, we're police. We just can't go take over someone's property. And fortunately,
you can't.
No, yeah, you can't.
I thought you could.
Yeah, we can't park 500 police cars on someone's parking lot and just say, "Hey, this is our parking lot for the next 7 days." But fortunately, we have really good partnerships in that area, and we had reached out to a local community college. Their head of security, and he was gracious. And it was during COVID, so they weren't having class anyways, or if they were, it was very limited. And he gave us permission to use their entire parking lot, which had a good access control point. And that was my first thing I was looking for, is how can I control access to this? Because I feel like security is really important, particularly in this situation. We didn't want any of the protesters coming to our staging location and essentially starting an additional protest at that location, which brought up our second challenge, is that the protest was constantly moving. Like, it started at this area, and then we would find on social media that now they're going to do a protest in this area, which there was a park right next to our staging location, which meant we had to move our staging location from the parking lot we are currently in to another parking lot. So I had to find an additional staging location and work through all the logistics of moving 200 police 200-plus police officers, in addition to a change of shift to a different location, and the communication therein was certainly complicated, but using many of the processes that we teach at C3 Pathways, it really enabled a smooth transition. And what in my mind, my number one priority is I want to ensure that the officers know where they're going, what they're doing, and why they're doing it, so that they're not disgruntled. Because I know this will be shocking to all of you guys, but there's nothing worse than a disgruntled police officer, particularly in staging. They find creative ways to do things that just drive you a little nutty.
Yeah, firemen too.
What's your joke about the three steel balls?
Yeah, you put a fireman in a room with three steel balls, come back an hour later, one will be broke, one will be missing, and they won't know nothing about it. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. And, you know, you and I ran into this when we were going to Katrina, right? You know, we staged for a long time with our task forces, and the worst thing you do is have them just standing around. They're tearing stuff up.
Yeah. Absolutely. And one of the things or the aspects of staging that I didn't think about until I was doing this and I had the large amount of resources is I was working with the ops section chief, which was Travis Cox. He's also an instructor here. And he wanted to know, what are my resources in staging, and create that common operating picture. And that's where we started kind of really thinking of some innovative ideas where a separated command post or a separated law branch or whatever branch could understand what was in staging, because they're ordering resources, but sometimes in the communication there would be some hiccups, and you would order 20 police officers and 40 police officers would show up. And when you talk about finances and overtime and all these other aspects that come into play when you have these resources, you want to know, do I have what I ordered? And if I don't, what do I have? Is it less? Is it more? So that they can adequately staff whatever group or resource or strike team that they're trying to form and put into place, that they have the adequate resources for that.
Yeah. How many folks did you have working with you, Ken, in staging?
Yeah. So I had an assistant staging manager, and I also was able to get many of the resource unit leader team members over to assist with the check-in and kind of managing that flow into staging. Because as I had mentioned, we wanted to make sure we had a access point and an exit point, so that we just didn't have officers kind of going in different ways, either coming in or leaving. And it was easier to keep accountability of folks when you had one point of entry and one point of exit. But the challenge is that you didn't want to have a large line of resources checking in and just killing time waiting in line. So we got a bunch of resources checking.
And I'll be honest, the reason I ask is that, you know, you think of these staging models, you know, and even the one we're using where you have one law enforcement officer, one fire EMS person. But you do what you need to be successful, right?
Right.
And again, Instant Command System allows that, right? I mean, if you're a practitioner of the Incident Command System, that allows that.
Absolutely.
It allows you to do check-in and staging. It allows you to do those things that you need to do to be successful. But, Bill, the one point that I wanted to make I think is really important. You know, I think the mentality is, if I stop in staging, we're wasting time. And really the truth of the matter is, if you stop in staging, you get an assignment, you get a task, you go downrange with that assignment and task, you have the information you need to be successful, it's actually faster. Right. And I think that's the important thing.
You know, Bruce, I completely agree with you. One of the and having been doing this for so long now, I mean, we've been doing the training and teaching this for over a decade. And I remember some of the early conversations with some key law enforcement figures as we were working through processes and procedures and saying, you know, because they kept saying, I need every gun downrange. And I said, look, I agree, but don't you need every gun exactly where you need them when you need them? And they said, well, yeah, and looked at me kind of puzzled. And I said, how are you going to make sure, if you've got 10 guns, 12 guns, 20, whatever that number is, how are you possibly going to make sure that each one is where they need to be when you need them there if you don't organize this a little bit? And that was kind of a breaking point. I mean, now, you know, Robert, you've been in the business a long time. How many years on total?
32
years. And you've seen a lot in your career change. How does what we're doing now, what we're training now, compare and contrast to the very first one you experienced?
Oh, it's light years ahead of where we started. And, you know, you guys talk about managing resources and making sure you have guns downrange where you need them. And that's very important. And, you know, we talked about the time factor here and saving time. And Ken alluded to, you know, how law enforcement often has to go find somebody and what are you doing and try and repurpose them. If you have officers in staging, when that next task comes up, like perimeter group or reunification security or whatever it is, you don't have to go try and pick them out of the mass that's out there and try and repurpose them and figure out if they're doing something essential now or can I repurpose them for something else. They're going to be there. That will save time. That will drive towards a better result in these things. And we just have to remember that from Columbine, when we experienced that, to today, the way we do this has changed, and it's got to keep changing, and we got to keep getting better at it, because at the end of the day, we're here to save lives, but that's not the only thing we do there. We've got a whole other incident to manage once we've saved the lives. It's still an incident.
Yeah, we have to save lives, and not just the traumatic injuries of the physical body, but also the recovery of those survivors. And as we've all learned, sometimes painfully so, how that incident gets managed can have a positive or a negative impact on the long-term recovery of survivors, the recovery of the community, and the ability to, you know, to kind of pick yourself up and not let that define you. I remember my conversation vividly with a young lady that was a survivor of one of these horrific events. And she said, the turning point for me in my recovery was when I shifted from seeing myself as a victim to seeing myself as a survivor. And this thing happened, but it doesn't define me. And I thought that was a really, really powerful message. We talked just not that long ago with John Michael Keyes, and about the idea. I was reminded as I re-listened to that, because that podcast we originally recorded right before COVID in December of 2019, before COVID, and I had forgotten we were talking about reunification. We were talking about the new SAVEM program, School Safety and Violent Event Incident Management course we're doing. And the tail end of the conversation, we got talking about this idea of an emotionally responsible room entry. And I kind of had forgotten about that conversation because COVID just kind of derailed everything that we were working on. And I realized that we needed to pick that back up. And I know it can be a difficult challenge for us to think about as responders. But when these events occur, especially when they occur with young kids, and you've dealt with the threat, you've dealt with the injured, now it's time to start clearing and moving the kids to a secure offsite reunification. How you do that, how you make those room entries, can either help or harm the emotional health of the traumatization of the kids, of those children. And the conversation we were having, and this is one I think that law enforcement really needs to grapple with, and there's not an easy answer. And that's part of the frustrating part, is there's not easy answers to some of these things. But how do you do a tactically safe room entry without scaring the bejesus out of a bunch of little kids? You know, what does that look like?
Right. And from my professional experience, if the threat is neutralized or you have good information to believe that the threat is not in that location, then it's a slow and deliberate room entry, which is doing clearing as much of the room as you can from the outside of the door, which means a less dominating room entry, right? So if we're just conducting a pie from outside the room, you're able to identify the people inside the room. You can talk to them. The emotions aren't as high because you're taking your time. And I know from my agency's perspective, that's the tactic that we adopt once the threat has been neutralized or we have a known location for the threat, is that the rest of the structure is just a slow and deliberate. We're using mirrors, we're using cameras, we're using any and all technology that we can leverage to clear the inside of the room from outside.
Interesting. I think we probably could and should do an entire podcast just on this topic and maybe have, maybe do a roundtable of some of our law enforcement instructors to kind of talk about what that might look like. Robert, I know that you have some personal passions on this subject. Robert, you mind coming back and talking about that in another podcast?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Well, we'll get that one scheduled in the future. It was an interesting tangent from a staging podcast. I'm not even sure how we got there, but gentlemen, thank you very much for coming in and talking about this important topic. Ken, Robert, Bruce, it's always a pleasure to have you here.